Welcome to Shrink Wrap, a podcast where Fran and Becky give proper respect to various mental health and wellness topics
while adding in a little bit of smart assery that they just can't seem to contain.
This podcast cannot and does not constitute therapy advice.
However, we do hope that you find the information we share with you helpful and entertaining.
Please be advised that this podcast discusses topics that can be sensitive to some listeners. Use appropriate discretion.
Welcome.
Welcome, everybody. This pen took a crap.
Oh, that was a need to know
factoid. Now I don't have a pen.
Oh, no. So what are we talking about today, Becky?
Well, are we jumping right into that or are we going to do business first?
Okay, let's do business.
Did you get it to work?
Yeah. Aww, business Brody. Before pleasure.
Okay. What's our business?
Well, as always, the really great way that you can support the show, if you like the tomfoolery that you're hearing on here, share it. Share it with your friends. Share it with your loved ones. Share it with your enemies if you want, if there's a good one. But go ahead and drop a like. Drop a subscribe. That really helps to get it out into the algorithms. And it's super duper great. So we're... There are notes being scribbled and passed back and forth. Is there something you'd like to share with the class here, Fran?
We'll share with the class. I have something I want to share with the class. So I have to read a review that was left in the middle of February from one of our fantastic listeners. He's devilishly handsome and a wise man. He's a silver fox.
Is he holding a fish, a giant fish?
Talking about Jim, so.
He's okay. Not holding a fish. Okay. No. Right. He is Tattoo Hey. He will know who he is. And he said, a great way to start the week. The first podcast I listen to every week, Becky and Fran bring on some great info, but also I end up with a belly laugh every episode.
Hell yes, you do.
I especially like it when she talks about her brothers. I've met them and they are as cool as they sound.
Aww, cool.
Spot on, Tattoo Hey. You are absolutely right.
Thank you for the review.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
And if you would like to leave us a review, we'd be happy to read that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Leave reviews. But again, the five-star reviews are great. Leaving reviews is great. But sharing it with your friends, sharing it with your loved ones, that really helps to, if more people listen, then it bumps it up into the algorithms and the robots tell other people to listen to it. And that's what we need.
And okay. Fran sent me an email yesterday about Chartable. So then that prompted me to log into our Chartable. You guys, you ready?
Yeah.
We're number 213 in Uruguay.
Are you? Yay, Gway!
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, that rhymes.
Thanks, Uruguay.
Yeah.
Yay, Gway.
Yeah. If you are listening in Uruguay right now.
We love you.
Yeah, please send us an email and tell us who is listening. So where would they send that email, Becky?
Shrinkwrap, that's R-A-P, 605 at gmail.com. That is shrinkwrap605 at gmail.com.
There you go. It. We'd love to hear from you all over the world.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about this really light topic we have today.
Okay, let's
that
do.
You and I are still going to manage to make fun of because we're awful humans.
Well, I don't know why this is plural but in discussion, but whatever.
We are delighted to have a guest today to talk about hospice. I'll let you introduce her.
Lisa Howard.
I was supposed to introduce her, wasn't I?
Yeah, you really
were. No wonder you looked at me with daggers.
Okay, I didn't.
Do you want to do it or should I do it?
No, because you have the credentials in your magical hands.
Okay, I'm really sorry, listeners. That was 100% on me. I'm the idiot. It's not plural anymore, Lisa. I'm the idiot.
You're the problem, it's you.
It's me. We have Lisa Howard with us today. She is a registered nurse with her bachelor's of nursing. She has been in nursing, you guys, for 35 years.
That's amazing.
35 years, 20 in acute care. And she's in her 15th year with hospice. And I've known Lisa a lot of years through Avera St. Luke's. And the work you do is nothing short of like an angel here on earth. And
amen.
I'm not blowing smoke up your ass. Yep. That is a true statement. Mm-hmm. I've known so many families who you and your staff have made this really what could be a horrible experience. There's kindness and compassion
and comfort,
dignity,
yes.
All of those things mm-hmm. that you bring at a really awful time. Mm-hmm.
I call it a sacred experience, to be honest.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty rewarding and it's a privilege.
It is a privilege, yeah.
Okay.
All right, are we ready, Fran?
We're ready.
Oh, boy.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Frantastic Factoid.
Mental health services and hospice settings are severely lacking. Studies have suggested... Oh, my God. This is going on and on and on.
It's hard hitting. Just a minute.
Okay. Okay. Studies have suggested that in these settings, significant psychiatric symptoms are prevalent, but often unacknowledged. They tend to be thought of as normal responses to anticipated death, not assessed, underdiagnosed, or undertreated, according to San Diego Hospice and the Institute for Palliative Medicine.
So it's almost like we're saying, oh, you're extremely sad. Of course you are. Let's move on.
Right.
Yeah. And then I mean, there's the duh, right? Of course you're extremely sad. However, what we hope you guys hear is that you can be extremely sad and get help.
Right.
There are things we can do.
Mm-hmm. And that is why, like, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross spent her, I mean, she was groundbreaking.
Kubler. She was.
Kubler?
Kubler.
Kubler.
Yeah. How did I say it?
Cougar.
Cobbler?
Kugler.
Like apple Kugler. Cobbler? Okay.
No, like cougar.
All right. See, we can okay. Just stop. You know, that is why she spent a significant part of her career literally talking to people that are dying and really, really bringing out your feelings. What are your concerns? You know,
talking with their loved ones.
Talking with their loved ones. But it was so, and it still is. Like, once we know someone is dying, it's almost like we're scared to have honest, open conversations with them.
You know, you don't want to remind them.
Right, because they know, we don't want to bring it to their mind.
Right. Which, I mean, I'm making fun of it. I know I've done it myself. It's a very natural thing, I think, to want to gloss over it, but... Okay. Yeah.
I call it the big white elephant in the room.
Yeah.
You know, you can be talking to a 97-year-old and I'll say to the family before I go in, you know, has your dad brought up, you know, his wishes, you know, cremation versus, you know, traditional, have, you know, talked about a church versus, you know, a memorial or celebration of life service. And people will be like, oh, no, we wouldn't want to bring that up to Dan. It's like, he's 97.
Yeah. Bob time.
I think he knows.
Yeah.
And so it's amazing because the dad doesn't want to bring it up and concern the kids or the spouse. But, you know, then the kids are afraid to bring it up, too. So
because they don't want to upset mom and dad.
That's right.
What is the difference between, I'm going to jump into questions.
Yeah.
What is the difference between hospice and palliative care? And the reason I wanted to ask that one is I generally don't know. Mm-hmm. I genuinely don't know the answer to this. Mm-hmm.
If you consider your health being on a continuum, palliative care is when someone has a chronic illness and they're looking for maybe symptom control, education, support, but they can still be seeking treatment, whether it's cancer treatment, surgery, you know, interventions of any kind. So it's not that they're maybe terminal. They're just dealing with a chronic illness. And if you think of palliation, that's comfort care.
Okay, so I was going to say, I don't know what that word
there's
means.
There's palliative radiation, which is for bone pain related to cancer.
Okay.
But palliative is the patient can still seek interventions, chemo, you know, go to the hospital, have procedures, those kind of things. Whereas hospice is someone's been determined to have 6 months or less to live. And that's, of course, a guess. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows that for sure. But it's the physician's best guess if we look at how the last 6 months have gone, that they won't be with us in 6 months. And that's when someone would qualify for hospice.
Yeah. You know, back in the day when I worked at Northern the first time around in the early 2000s, I had a student that I had been seeing off and on for a plethora of things that were going on in their life. And she came in one day and she goes, "What's hospice?" And I said, "Why are you asking?" And she goes, "Well, you know, my dad's been really sick." And I said, "Yeah." And she goes, "They're saying something about hospice. What does that mean?" And I went, "Oh, shit." And so I went and got the nurse at Northern at the time. And I said, "Hey, can we have a conversation with her together?" Yeah, because nobody had really filled her in on what that meant.
Yeah. Yeah, it can be very scary. A lot of people avoid the word hospice because they think it means death is within the next few days. Instead of thinking, you know, if things continue, it could be that grandpa or dad won't be with us in 6 months. But like I said, we actually have people that come off of hospice or graduation off of hospice because you've gotten their symptoms under control. You've maybe, you know... just supported them and gotten the right things in their home in terms of equipment and taught their family how to manage medications and things like that. And so sometimes we do have them graduate off of hospice. Doesn't mean they can't
have
it again.
That's so cool. Yeah.
Do you hold the ceremony and everything?
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Like a little cap.
I'd be like, I want my hat. You should get something, damn.
Yeah, no kidding.
I picture on the top of that hat, it's a bone giving a thumbs up. Or a middle finger to death. To be death, like, fuck right. you, death.
That's right.
I graduated hospice, bitch.
That's right.
Not yet. And then they could go back on down the road. Whether that's weeks, months, years later, because they've, you know, had another issue with their disease process or another disease process.
Okay.
So,
but it's not today, Satan, for
that's
the graduates.
Right. That's right.
Okay. So one thing that has happened to me over the years in working with clients is they tell me one of their relatives has been diagnosed as terminal or is extremely sick and the prognosis doesn't look good. And so I will bring up, has anyone discussed with you hospice? And many of them have not had it introduced to them yet. And so I just kind of wanted to know, what is a typical process where a doctor or nurse brings it up to the family? How does that usually go?
You know, sometimes it's when the patient's hospitalized and they've had a major change in their health status, or they've had a new diagnosis, or they've suffered a stroke and now they're having problems swallowing. And you start asking those questions. Have they ever decided if they want a feeding tube or not? You know, we're not going to be able to keep their nutrition up. And so sometimes it does come from a hospital care, maybe the social worker working with them as they're trying to talk about what their discharge plans are. And sometimes it's actually the patient or the family that brings it up. I don't want any more of this. Mm-hmm. You know, I want quality. I don't want to spend the next several months going in and out of a clinic getting IV fluids or having more tests. I want to travel. I want to do the things I want to do. So, the order actually has to come from a physician, their physician, but the patient or the family or a caregiver of any kind can bring it up. For us, sometimes it's the caregivers at a nursing home or an assisted living. And it's okay for the family to address it or to say to the physician, Dad said he doesn't want to do this anymore. What's our options? Mm-hmm. You know?
So let's give you the floor to talk about advanced directives. Right? Like, how important are those?
Explain what those are.
So a living will is maybe the same type of thing, but an advance directive, if you can't speak for yourself, then these are my wishes and all that. I actually, feather in my cap, taught a death and dying class at Northern many years ago. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things I had my students do. Like, my buddy Aaron Darling is he's a realtor, but he's also a notary. So I said, if you want to fill out an advance directive, I will have it notarized. You can send it to your parents or to your loved ones or whoever.
Oh, that's going to not scare the shit out of your parents.
Well,
when you're
at least you know, right?
Yeah,
and
true.
I've had these conversations.
I hate winter's coming up. I plan on getting really messed up just in case it goes awry.
Oh, no.
I've had this conversation with my parents even, and they're like, no, if you fill out an advance directive, then it's deadlocked, and that's the only thing that can happen. So if I change my mind, you don't know it. So my parents actually won't fill it out. And it's been a point of contention. But anyway, blah, blah, blah. Talk about advance directives in your work.
There's advance directives that are specific. There's one called a POLST, POLST, physician order related to life-saving treatment. And it's very specific. I want antibiotics. I want oxygen. I want to go back and forth to the hospital or not. And they can sign any of those things. Of course, everybody hears on TV and stuff, DNR, do not resuscitate or do not intubate. And that is something that is important to discuss. And then, of course, the advance directive of durable power of attorney. Because the big thing is, if you can't speak for yourself, who is the person that knows your wishes? Mm-hmm. And then these documents, and they should be notarized, need to be shared with your family. It's not enough that they're in a safe somewhere or they're sitting in a clinic. You really need to share them with your family so that they know. And it's okay to change your mind. Once you fill out an advance directive, you update it and make a different decision. it's okay just to update it.
Just get it re-notarized?
Correct. Okay. Or get it, you know,
just redo it.
Okay. And they always have them at the hospital or in clinics with a social worker. And it should be notarized, and you should share it with your family and, of course, your physician and caregivers.
And for the most part, you can make anybody.
Correct.
Right, the decision maker? Because I think that's been a big thing. Like, if you've never been married, but you've been domestic partners for however many years, I don't know if this is a myth or not, but legally you don't have any say in that moment. So if you had an advance directive,
correct,
then your partner would have the say in that moment.
True, true.
So anybody,
and it might not be your spouse. It might be, you know, somebody that isn't as emotionally involved that you've shared your wishes with, you know, that can step back and say in the moment, she wouldn't want this to continue on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am my mom's because she's like, your dad will be a mess.
Mm-hmm. I actually chose my daughter that's a nurse because I know she understands the process. We've talked about it. And it's not because I don't think my husband can do the job, but I just think it would help him.
Yeah. I think my dad, who's made over the course of his almost 86 years, has made some really incredible decisions. He's been a businessman most of his life and lots of things. But when it comes to my mom, that's his wife.
So have you had situations where there's the advance directive and it's very clear, but then the dad or the husband steps in and says, over my dead body, are you going to pull that plug? Even though that's what it says on the piece of paper.
Just like Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, about Grey's it happens all the time.
I will say that I don't have plugs because usually with hospice, they are in a home setting. They're not in a hospital setting where I do. But what I say is I don't undermine him. I don't try and get him to change his mind, but I stop and I talk about what's her wishes, you know, how does that make you feel? Try and build a rapport. And if they're not ready at that point in time to say, I can't do this, give them time, you know, build that rapport and the relationship and the trust that it takes to say, I just want you to know this seems futile. What was going on last week? We've made another decline, you know, and try and explain that to them and give them time. It's like, I'm not here to twist an arm, you know, but in a hospital setting, there might be a physician that says, nope, this is what we have. And of course, sometimes it goes to ethics, you know, if it's something that truly is, you know, not in their best interest, not, you know, not just from a medical standpoint, but for the person, you know, that could be long-term on a ventilator without any sign of improving.
I'm going to go off script for one more question and then I'll be quiet. But so that on the ethics point, and you can decline to answer or whatever, but what are your thoughts on then assisted suicide or physician assisted suicide?
You had to go there.
Again, you don't have to answer. But I think especially for hospice workers, I think it's a fascinating topic, but again, respectfully.
I appreciate that. You know, I work for a Catholic institution and, we use medications that help with pain control. And even on a Catholic institution, even if it, hastens death, if you're using it for the right reason, not to cause death, but because you're trying to get the pain or the dyspnea under control or the anxiety and things like that. But I just feel there's too many factors for assisted suicide where they take pills and go to sleep and not wake up. I have a hard time with that. I think there's too many other things out in the periphery that, you know, family and that has to deal with that. But that's my personal thoughts.
It's not black and white.
No, it's definitely not
black and white.
No, nothing is. Yeah, because it'd be easy to say, oh, well, they're terminal and they're in pain. And if they want to end their life, let them end their life. But there could be all those other things out there that you don't know. It could be a misunderstanding. It could be a lot of things.
There could be regrets for the family later on because they've supported that decision, things like that. I feel like we're not doing a good enough job of managing their symptoms if they're going that next route of, I want to end this now.
Oh, that's a good point,
You know, there's always some type of reason I feel like people are still with us, whether it's to teach us patience, whether to say, you know, give family more time to have their ability to reconcile or have their moments with that loved one and things like that.
The only thing that I struggle with is I cannot bear to see other people in pain. So if like somebody is suffering, you know, just so I can process their death, that's what I would have a problem with. And that's why we chose hospice for my dad, because it got to the point where he literally was drowning in his own fluid. His kidneys were going out. I couldn't bear it. I absolutely could not bear that. And so having the option at that point of hospice, and we were in Arizona, so it wasn't in our home. They had a hospice home. Was, I cannot tell you how reassuring and comforting it was to see him get morphine and to just sleep easy. I put, you know, those little airline things that you put around your neck?
Like a neck pillow?
Yeah. They sat him up. I gave him my little neck pillow. He was, he literally, you could see peace. Like there was no pain. And for me to watch that, golden.
Right.
I didn't care that he couldn't talk anymore. I just did not want him to suffer. Right.
And that, I think, is the goal. And I always ask the patient, what's your goal? It might be that they can stay communicative, you know, until their last moment. But and then as we go along, it's like, now is it, is your goal comfort? Is your goal to be able to rest and not, you know, have that feeling of where am I? What's going on? You know, that anxiety that can come with end of life.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that there's that 6 month mark. They're terminal. We're approximately 6 months, give or take, or maybe graduate. What are some of the other criteria for somebody to be admitted into hospice care and get that doctor's order?
You know, that the patient is on board with it, that we have to have a, not only their physician order, but a medical director looks at their chart, and sometimes they'll have us come in and evaluate, but they have to have a terminal diagnosis. It can't be enough that they're 103, for gosh sakes, they're dying. It has to be that they have, it could be heart failure, it could be cancer, it could be AIDS, it could be liver failure, a stroke, a brain injury. Let's see, renal failure is a good one. Someone's chosen not to do dialysis anymore. You know, all a host of it. It can be protein calorie malnutrition. They're now 75 pounds and they're not eating. And and we've, you know, it could be that they had a hip fracture that they chose not to get fixed, you know. So
that just sounds painful.
In grad school, or right after grad school, I was part of a research study about hip fractures. And we were looking at the psychological and physical recovery after a hip fracture in older adults. I cannot believe that you said that. And
54% of people after a hip fracture will die in the first year.
Absolutely. Wow. And so that's what the study was looking at. And of course, shocker, Fran's fantastic factoid here, that the more social support you had before the hip fracture, the more likely you were to, you know, carry on and go. But it's a big deal to break a hip. That's that's a game changer.
Wow. Very true. That.
So, okay, this is more of a philosophical question, because to you, you said this work is sacred, and I totally believe that. So for you personally, what is the purpose of hospice?
The purpose of hospice is to walk that journey with the patient and family, because we always consider it both the patient and family that you're helping, because there might come a time where the patient's not even responsive, that they're comatose, and you're just trying to explain to the family, you know, what to expect, what things might look like going forward, what can we do to, you know, to keep them comfortable. And it could be, I kind of tell them sometimes it's nursing 101, how to reposition someone, how to change their incontinence, how to change a bed sheet with the person in it, you know, and those kind of things. But the purpose is whatever I can do to make this journey understood and as comfortable as I can, whatever that looks like. And I want to make sure that you know that at the end of 6 months, it doesn't mean they automatically come off a hospice. If they still, you know, meet the criteria, we can continue hospice on indefinitely. And it's just that our medical director has to make visits every 60 days. We've had people on for years. And because they still are declining, they're just not doing it as quickly as maybe we thought they would, you know, at the beginning of their services.
What a strange world that must be for you, right? Like, because you have the people who it's 3 to 6 months and that's it, and or versus the people who they're not getting better, but they're slowly, slowly declining over a course of years.
The relationships you build are unbelievable. Yeah. It's unbelievable, and it's why I do what I do.
So absolutely, because, you know, you're not just, like you said, you're educating the family, and I'm sure you're also assessing, like, could somebody in the family need some help? Like, are they really at a point where they need some intervention?
And I ask the patient oftentimes, and this is why we like to see people sooner than later. Mm-hmm. Most patients' families, we send surveys out like everybody does, you know, what do you wish you maybe would have, you know, we would have done sooner. I wish we would have done it sooner rather than wait, because they realize that for the full benefit of hospice, it's best if it can be over a period of months and not just days. Because you build that rapport, you get to know what their wishes are. You actually really get to know the family too. Mm-hmm. And I always ask the patient, who's going to struggle the most when you're gone? Mm-hmm. You know, because oftentimes it might be the neighbor boy that comes over for, you know, after school every day. It might not be their spouse. You know, they've dealt with that and stuff. So, and even if I lose my patient, I see the family later, you know, in a small town, USA, you really do. You know, it's like I have cared for spouses over a period of years. I have, you know, cared for a mother and then years later, a daughter, you know, so it's amazing the cycle that you get to see.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm going off script now. How do you guys care for your mental health? Because that's heavy.
It is. You know, I have found that as long as what I'm doing is for the benefit of the patient, you know, and following their wishes and taking care of myself, the team, we meet every week and we talk about our patients that we've recently lost, what went well, what could we have done better, who do we think is going to be the person that we really need to stay in touch with. You know, self-care can be walking. It can be, for me, it was a massage today.
Good for you.
Know, just, and you know, expressing what you're going through, you know, and we will debrief after certain, you know, very tough situations. As I get older, my patients are getting younger than myself, and that can be a real struggle. It's like, this just doesn't seem fair, and as we know, life isn't fair. So,
well, and to go off of friends about it's sacred work, I got a buddy from high school whose wife is a you all are a different breed. Like, it's I couldn't do it, and it takes a certain very special type of person to be able to do that work. So
it's funny you say that, because as I'm sitting here listening to Lisa, I'm thinking, listeners, you know, nobody wants to imagine this, but imagine you or a loved one had to go into hospice. All I can tell you is, when you think of who you want caring for you, Lisa is that person.
Yes, absolutely.
She just exudes it. You really do.
Thank
you.
Yes.
Yeah. I do think that there's something special. You know, a lot of people love labor delivery and postpartum, and that's a great thing. Wasn't my thing.
Not that great.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, that's what a lot of young people that are going into the medical profession think, and it is. It's great, but it's just as special and sacred at the end.
Absolutely.
You know, when you usher them out of this world. And that's what I kind of consider it as ushering.
Go ahead.
Do you go through, and maybe this is inside baseball, but do you go through as the practitioner the stages of grief sometimes, or are you detached enough from it? Or is it case by case? Industry wide, is that something that happens with everything? And maybe go through the stages of grief for those who don't know it.
Well, denial. You know, and I guess I don't get to do that one. I don't get to do that one. But bargaining, maybe, you know, I really want to try and help them make it to this event, or they really want to see this special birthday or grandchild, you know, it's hard because you kind of make a bargain, you know, with the physician or the family, and I'll do everything I can to try and help them get there, you know. Acceptance is probably, I do okay with that, because I feel like if I've done my job well, you know, I'm not causing death, I'm not hastening death, I'm just trying to walk whatever this process is going to look like. And it's different. I say it's kind of like bringing life into this world. It's labor. Mm-hmm. It's work. Mm-hmm. Stages are different in terms of everyone and the time frame and all the things that happen or don't happen. So it's I would say that I do usually get to a point of acceptance. There's some that are more of a struggle for me to deal with than others. You know,
I think when you said the whole this isn't fair thing, I think there's a little anger that goes with that.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is one of the stages too. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, I can say like when my stepdad was in hospice, it was me, my mom and my half stepbrother. And she told us, OK, now he's very, very close. We all sat around him. And we all put our hands on him. And it was one of the most beautiful and sacred moments of my entire life. And we were just telling him how much we love him and what we remember about him. And it was okay to go. And it was just beautiful. It was like, I was so honored to be there. Like, what
it's a sacred privilege.
It is a privilege to welcome someone in the world and to usher someone to their next journey, right?
Right.
It was just beautiful. And I'm so glad, like, hospice allowed that because they told us, they walked us through every single step. It was fantastic. It really was.
This is, you know, being able to say it's going to be normal if you see these long pauses in their breathing and the color of their skin changes and their hands and feet become cold and they may start picking at the air. They may start talking to people that aren't there.
Or you know, are they?
Right.
Yeah. Well, they just are for saying. That person.
Right.
And I always say, don't correct them. Mm-hmm. Ask them, well, what are they saying? What do they have on? How old are they? Because it can be amazing as they have, I kind of call it one foot in both worlds, you know, what they're experiencing.
Right. Yeah, that's a beautiful, beautiful thing. Tell us, like, okay, what is hospice like here in Brown County, and then what might it be in other areas?
You know, we're very rural. Right now, Avera at Home is the only hospice that serves Aberdeen, so we are blessed to be able to work with both the Avera physicians and Sanford physicians. The VA can also give us patients, but we are traveling about 60 miles from Aberdeen. Our goal is to try and butt up against another hospice. So we will go to Bristol, we will go to Condi, Doland, Bowdell, Britton is fairly new, Redfield, and then Leola. We cannot go into another state. We don't have the licensure to go into North Dakota, so it stays in South Dakota. But Red River Valley out of Fargo has a very strong hospice.
So you guys do butt up against theirs.
Yep. And then we butt up. I go as far as Bristol, and then Webster goes as far as the other direction, and that's out of Watertown. We are unfortunately don't have a hospice house. They are, you know, they cost a lot of money, and you have to have a lot of resources. But there is one in Rapid City and two in Sioux Falls. So they tend to be bigger, you know, cities that are able to support hospice houses.
What are the pros and cons? And maybe this is a dumb question, but what are the pros and cons between a hospice house or having hospice at your own home?
You know, as our families become, you know, two income families, or we don't have that multi-generational help, or our kids live far away, it might be too much for someone to care for someone in the home, you know, and it doesn't make it right or wrong. It's just not going to work in that particular situation. It might be that they have a lot more pain control issues that need to be in a more medical facility. Or like I say, the family just says, I know we can't do this, you know, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
So what is it like? I want you to just tell the listeners, like, what is it like to actually watch someone die? What can they expect?
You know, it's a process. And I always say dying isn't a straight line from having good day to bad day. It's really cyclical. It's a roller coaster. Some days are good. Some are not good. Some days, you know, it's an hour that's good out of the day. And not to expect, I can't predict, you know, that's the other thing I tell people is I will tell you the best nursing judgment that I have, and I can maybe say it's going to be hours to a day or two, or I think we've got weeks. it's oftentimes the patient will have very lucid moments. Other times, like I said, they might be hallucinating or very confused, seeing and talking to people that you don't see. And I'm not saying they don't see them. I'm just saying that the loved one doesn't see it. Oftentimes there's a change in breathing pattern, you know, where they have long apnea spells, where they have pauses and you're like, oh my gosh, I think they've gone. And then all of a sudden they do this snoring type of breath. That's very normal at end of life. Color changes, temperature changes. Sometimes we run fevers because we have a thermostat in our brain called the hypothalamus that goes a little haywire. You know, oftentimes they're, you know, semi-conscious to an unconscious state at the very end. So it really varies. I've had patients that are talking up until the moment they pass, and I've had patients that have been unresponsive for days and days before they pass. So it really is variable.
Hey, Becky, why is the Northern State University graduate program in counseling so awesome?
I could go on forever, but let's talk about the fact that you can get a clinical degree where you can work in private practice or an agency, or you can get a school counseling degree on the school track where you can work in a school as private school, parochial school, public school, any school you want to. And then my favorite.
What?
Forensic counseling.
Super cool. Yes. But is it KCREP approved?
It is KCREP approved. And you're like, what does that mean? You know what? It means that it has the gold standard of grad schools.
Super awesome. But can I afford it? Because I don't have a lot of money.
It's okay. If you go to northern.edu, you can apply for some scholarships. They have a couple of counseling specific scholarships in addition to some other really fantastic scholarships that a guidance counselor or a admissions counselor can help you with.
Awesome. Be Northern, unleash your potential, baby.
Oh. With that wide variance, do you find that people or family members have this expectation of what it's going to be like, right? That, okay, I'm going now. I see the bright light. I love you all. And as very opposed to what it, you know, what it's actually like.
They think it's going to be an event like it is on TV. And it's usually not, you know, it's usually just kind of a drifting off type of situation, but it's just so, so sacred to be there and to be able to say, and we always talk about the hearing being the sense that they still have at the very end, even if they are hard of hearing, oftentimes that becomes more acute as some of the other senses become less, I should say. So I always say what you need to say. Mm-hmm. And if it shouldn't be said at the bedside, please take it somewhere else. If you think it'll be distressing.
Go find a therapist.
Yeah, right.
Say it to them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, so it's very, very unique for everybody's passing.
One of the things that I've heard over the years, and I want to know your experience with it, is people have related stories like, let's just say grandpa is, he's almost gone, right? But he hangs on until the last sibling gets there or, you know, whatever it might be, or the grandchild or whatever. How, I mean, what's your experience like with that?
I have seen it. I have actually seen it where they didn't want to die on someone's birthday, or they wanted to make it to a graduation, or you know, I've had patients tell me, I'll see you again. I never say I'll see you on Tuesday because I've learned that I don't want them to feel they have to wait for me because I am not that special. You know,
who of us has to think of that though?
Right.
You know what? I mean, that's just one more thing. A consideration.
So I just say, I'll see you again, you know, and go with that. And it's just amazing because oftentimes I'll probably be back next week. And they'll say, well, I'm not going to be here. And they oftentimes are right. They have a sense too, oftentimes.
I just think that's miraculous, unexplainable, maybe. I don't know.
It's kind of like a sixth sense. I mean, you get that with dogs too. You know, like we had a dog that I called the vet three times to put it down. I couldn't do it. And so I just couldn't. I didn't have it in me. And it was at the farm.
The dog fought back?
No, the dog, I didn't have this. I couldn't.
It didn't work, ma'am. You need to come back and put this dog down.
No, I couldn't.
No, it was the dog going, bitch, put me down. No. I am miserable. And Fran's like, I can't. I can't.
I can't do it. No, but we have. have, you know, the infamous sheep pile at the farm where all the dead sheep go, right?
And Jim almost went.
Yeah, where Jim, it's still a possibility if it pisses you off. But anyway.
Who doesn't have a sheep pile?
Yeah, right? It's kind of handy. But anyway, so our dog was disappeared, and literally it had walked down into the sheep pile and died.
Yeah.
And it had that sense that, okay, I'm not going to let you do it, but I'll do it when I'm ready.
Cats will do that too. They will go hide. When they're ready to pass.
And I hear so oftentimes families say, I don't want them to be alone, but sometimes they will it that way. If they're private people in life, they will wait until it's dark and everybody stepped out of the room. They could have a vigil going for days and they step out of the room to go to the bathroom or get a bite to eat. And that's when it happens. And they're like, oh my gosh, I missed it. And it's like, no, that's the way dad wanted it. Yeah. That's the way grandma wanted it. And it's hard for people to understand that. But I always try and preface it with that, too, so that they're not, like, you know, feeling like they're going to stay at the bedside for, you know, 2 weeks.
Right. That makes sense. I'm going to talk to my, after visiting about this with you, I want to talk to my mom and dad about when my grandma passed away, because she was a horribly private person. And I wouldn't surprise me if she just passed away in the middle of the night. It's been so long that I don't remember. But I'd be curious, because she would not want a big to do, a fuss, nothing.
Yep.
Do you think that people treat dying people differently? Like, what do you see with that, even with family members?
I do. I think we're not as comfortable with it as maybe some other cultures, or maybe from years back and things like that. We try and protect loved ones. I would say that it has to do with, you know, you'll hear them talk louder, more simply, not want to laugh in their presence for fear that it might upset them. And oftentimes I always say, tell the stories, because that, you know, people want to know, what will you remember? What was important? What are you going to miss about our time together? You know? And I always say, even if they're sleeping, it's okay for you guys to really admit who broke the lamp. You know?
No, I laughed when you said they talk louder, because it's like, I'm dying, I'm not going deaf. But that's such a human thing to do.
And maybe this is outside of your scope, but how, on the flip side of that, how should we, I don't have a lot of experience with death, so talking to somebody who has just lost somebody is, I think it's a struggle for me, but it's a struggle for everybody.
Definitely.
My wife's mother passed away when she was in her early 20s, and she remembers people seeing her in the grocery store, making eye contact and turning and going the other way, because they didn't know what to do, right?
Right.
If you can, talk about how we should talk to people who have just lost a loved one.
You know, people are worried about saying the wrong thing,
right?
You know, and I think that it's important to not use those euphemisms that we use, like, oh, they're in a better place, or they're the lucky one, and things
everything
like that
happens for a reason,
right?
Thoughts,
right?
And prayers.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, just what you miss about them, what you remember, you know, and that can even be done while they're on hospice, because they can be shared then. You know, we wait too long to let people know, even in that they're not close family members, but somebody in your community or a teacher or something that you had a relationship with, to say, oh, I'll always remember this about them. Please share that with them and things. But to not just say, I'm here for you, but I'm coming over and I've got lunch, you know, and I'm going to go grab some groceries. What can I get for you? And to not ignore the big white elephant in the room, which is, you have lost one of the most important people in your life. Let's talk about it, you know?
Great. Yeah.
Or let's not talk about it. Do you want to talk about it? Or would you rather talk about whatever's on TV? Or
hug them. If you don't know what the hell to say, you're a big burly guy. I bet you're a real cuddly hugger.
I am.
Yeah.
I'm very good at
it. So just give them a big hug. And, you know, one of my clients told me, and I thought this was such a great thing, because she saw, it was a husband and wife couple that were always together, and one of the husband died. And so at the funeral, afterwards, she's like, we're going to hang out, and this is what we're going to do. I'm going to come get you on this date, and we're going to do da da da. And she followed through with that, because she knew that her partner, the one she did everything with, was going to be gone, and that was going to be devastating.
Yeah.
So like you said, don't just say it, but do it.
Right, right. So true.
How did you decide this work, or did this work decide you?
You know, I will say I was 20 when my mom died, and it was in the 1980s, late 1980s. She was in a hospital ICU bed for 28 days on a ventilator and a feeding tube. And I thought, oh, it could be so different. I mean, we stayed on a different wing of the hospital, so we were very close. And it was hell, I will say, you know, and I don't think it's because she was that uncomfortable, but we all knew the writing on the wall. That was probably my initiation, my own cancer diagnosis. But then I've always appreciated being on a medical oncology floor when I was in my first several years of nursing, just being there and helping that process. It just was so meaningful. And that's kind of what turned me 15 years ago into hospice. It's where I'll retire, I promise.
Yeah, yeah, I see that.
It's what you were meant to do, really, ultimately.
Yeah.
It's a calling.
Yeah, so, okay, you mentioned, Brody, like talking to the person who lost the loved one. But what about, like, when you talk to the actual hospice person that's dying, how do you address dying with them other than just, like, you know, what are your funeral wishes? Like, what else do you ask them?
You know, I ask them first, what do you know about your illness? How do you think you're doing?
Yeah.
Because they might have a whole different, you know, thoughts about, you know, it's not what's on the CAT scan or what's in the chart. It's how do you feel like you're doing? What's become more difficult? What are you scared of? What can I try and help alleviate, you know, and try and walk you through this of what to expect? You know, who's going to be the one that struggles the most in your family? And usually I have time alone with the patient to have those discussions, because sometimes they don't want to have them in front of others, and I'm a neutral party. So I feel like those are some really good questions, but also to say, you know, have you talked to your family about your wishes? Have you decided, you know, where you want to be buried? And it's amazing that maybe they haven't talked or even thought about it.
Yeah.
But then I've had other patients that will write down not only we're going to eat on paper plates and we're going to have buns from this store and we're going to have this because I used to serve at funerals and I don't want anybody doing dishes.
Yeah. You know? That detail oriented.
Yeah. It's very interesting. You can go from one direction to the other, but and you kind of let them take you where the conversation's going to go. If they shut you down on some of those questions, you know, you say, okay, we'll talk later about those.
Marie, I know you're listening. I will not have Amazing Grace at your funeral. She has threatened to haunt anybody that allows that to happen.
Really?
That's my mom's only wish.
Is to have it.
Amazing Grace.
Yeah, and my mom's wish is to not have it. She loves it. She just doesn't want it at her funeral.
Yeah. Okay. I've had patients that have had the soloists come in and sing songs, and they get to pick which ones they want.
Auditions.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm taking that. I'm going to audition people.
Oh, my God.
You're going to have a big red X button.
I'm going to. And then I'm going to be like, what are you going to do? Argue with me? I'm dying. Get out of here.
Okay, I heard somebody, like, when they were lowering the casket, he had pre-recorded his voice. And so when they were lowering the casket, he was like, hey, everybody. And he started talking to everybody. Now, you got to appreciate somebody's sense of humor with that. It's like, if somebody was funny their whole life, and that's how you want to go out, I just love that, you know? It's awesome. Yeah.
Now I know what you're going to do.
I don't know. I got to come up with something better than that.
You're going to be like, no, wait, let me out.
Where's my oscillator?
I'm on the highway to hell. I don't know. I got to come up with something. But anyway. Oh, my God. So, okay. What is, and I don't know if you can tell us this, but just your most profound maybe witnessing of someone who is talking to someone from the other side or having that kind of experience. Have you ever witnessed that?
Yes. And it wasn't just talking to someone, but it was saying, I got to get on the bus. I'm going to miss the bus, or I got to pack. They're talking about getting somewhere, going on a trip, a journey and that. And I'll say, who are you going to see on this journey? And it's amazing. It could be a child that you know, a sibling that was lost and nobody even knew it. You know, their own kids didn't even know it and things like that, because maybe they just, you know, it would be too painful to bring it up in front of mom and things like that. So I would say asking them, you know, or having them express what they're experiencing, you know, and it's not necessarily a lucid conversation, but it's enough where you can get a really good feeling of what they're experiencing or who they're seeing and what's being said between them.
You know, as we're sitting here visiting, you remind me so much of my mom, who was a NICU nurse forever.
Oh.
And when we would go out and about, people, I mean, we would go to Bismarck and every single time somebody would come up and they'd have like a 10-year-old or a 15-year-old and be like, remember, she was only like 1 pound when she was born and look at her now. That has to happen to you, where people just remember you being that present for them at such an important time.
And that's the rewarding part is, you know, you see them in Kessler's and you get and they'll say, how's your kids doing? Did the one graduate? You know, because you start building relationships with, you know, the family members. So even though I may not see that patient, and sometimes I do if they graduated and such, but if I see a family member or whatever, and I'll say, I can almost see, you know, I might not recognize them as so-and-so's daughter or grandchild, but I can remember kind of the season, you know. Oh, I was driving in the winter, or it was sunny out and it was beautiful, and, you know, we had been spending time outside, or I can remember, you know, like what street it was on, but I maybe can't remember the actual name of the loved one.
But they remember you.
Yeah.
And it's you imprinted.
So, yeah. It's like I say, it's rewarding in so many ways.
Mm-hmm. And you have more of an intimate picture because you're actually in their homes. You know, that's a very different than a hospice house, you know.
And they're in a very vulnerable time, and they allow you to come into their home, which is, you know, personal space. You know, oftentimes it's personal needs that you're dealing with too, you know, and it can be really quick and heavy what you're dealing with, you know. Just the first time you meet them, you might be, you know, working in their personal space and things like that. So yeah, it's very vulnerable time. And we care for people not only in their own homes, but maybe it's a family member's home or an assisted living or long-term care. They can be provided in any situation. Wherever the patient lives is where we can provide the care.
Okay. What do you do? Like, I see patients sometimes that are obviously terminal, but their anxiety is off the charts. And they are, you know, they've had anxiety through life, but now knowing they're dying and worrying about, like, what are my kids going to do without me and my husband? They can't sleep. They are just literally jumping out of their skin with anxiety. How do you handle that?
You know, we will reach out to the physician. One of the standard meds we use is lorazepam, you know, to help with that anxiety, kind of quiet the mind a little bit. It's not uncommon to initiate an antidepressant.
That's Xanax, right?
No. Lorazepam's Ativan.
Okay.
Yeah, little shorter acting than Xanax. Sure. Xanax is longer acting, and so lorazepam is oftentimes, you know, one of our first go-tos for anxiety. You know, for sleep, we might use melatonin. We might, you know, and this is coming from a physician, but we oftentimes will reach out to the physician and say, you know, this is what they're doing and this is what we recommend. And we use Dr. Shauna Schmidt as our medical director for, and we also have a pharmacist that sits on it. So we're, you know, trying to use the right medication for the right purpose.
And I suppose being mindful of all the other medications that might be present as well.
Very true. Very true. And that's why we're blessed to have a pharmacist, you know, that sits on our team and helps us with, you know, recommendations of what might be helpful. And sometimes what we start with isn't going to be what's helpful down the road. But yeah, it definitely is, you know, physician driven, but they look to us as the person in the home day after day with what we think might be helpful. And so we're fortunate in that respect.
I think sometimes, like with pharmacists, we overlook their knowledge of like not only the side effects, but what are the interactional effects of all the different medications.
And they have actual databases that will just like you type in the meds and it's just boop.
And it does for us too. You know, it'll tell us if it's a level one or two interaction or if they already have something in the same family where you're duplicating it and things like that. And then, you know, it gives us an opportunity to reach out to the physician and see what would be the best and most appropriate.
Yeah. That's plan. Such a good point, though. I mean, if you can either reach out to your prescriber or don't ever hesitate to reach out to your pharmacist
right.
as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, you know, we oftentimes will encourage them to seek a counselor if they're able, or we will make contact and a mm-hmm. referral to Northeastern Mental Health Center mm-hmm. and things like that. And also the same with the family afterwards. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some people that are going to be a higher risk for bereavement, mm-hmm. you know, and hospice also keeps in touch with that family for 13 months after the death.
Oh, that's a long time.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And knowing that it's not necessarily 13 months, the right. grief process, but maybe, you know, they're going to want face-to-face visits or phone mm-hmm. calls or mailings mm-hmm. and things like that. And then we do a Tree of Life ceremony before Christmas, because we know mm-hmm. that's that first holiday season can be really tough, and it's an opportunity for us to get to see them together, to see that they're not alone in this process, mm-hmm. and maybe how they're feeling, and just a really special time for all of us to get to spend time with the families too. Mm-hmm.
Why 13 months? That seems like a very specific number.
You know, I can't tell you, Brody, I'll be honest.
I have a guess.
Do you?
You have 12 months, which would be your year of firsts.
Sure.
The first birthday, the first anniversary, the first Thanksgiving, the first Christmas. Mm-hmm. And then because I was wondering about this as you were talking, I'm like, maybe that 13th one is just to be like, whoa, we mm-hmm. did it.
Yeah.
And we can do more if you want.
Right.
But we made it through that first year.
Or if mm-hmm. you need more, maybe, and hopefully you know, our social workers are the ones that do that mm-hmm. bereavement part, and chaplain, is that they can also, if they see that someone's really struggling, that mm-hmm. they put them in contact with services before mm-hmm. then.
Right.
Because, you know, that's not their role, is to be the professional counselor. They're mm-hmm. there to try and help with the grief process. But oftentimes there's other things going on, you know, mm-hmm. that have exacerbated their grief.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you hear that 12-month number thrown mm-hmm. around a lot, and I would just like to throw out that myth that mm-hmm. it's ridiculous to think that after 12 months you're right. supposed to be skippity-doo, yay, whatever. It's mm-hmm. like you've loved that person forever, you know, or not even, maybe they're a baby that you lost, and there is no timeline on this.
No.
This mm-hmm. is different for every single human, and that's okay. That process is individual.
I always like Mike Cutler, who we had on here, taught me back in grad school, or taught us, that I think it's his tribe, they did a 3-year process. Mm-hmm. So you had 1 year of acute grieving, right? Your year first. And then you had another year. And then at the end of the third year, you did a celebration of that person who passed. Now, you weren't saying you were done with your grief, because like mm-hmm. You can't put a 3-year time limit on mm-hmm. it. But at least they weren't saying, okay, the funeral's done, now get on with it.
Right.
You can't change it. Who cares? You know, not who cares, but I think there's that. The funeral's over, now what?
Mm-hmm. And I think it comes in waves.
Yes.
You know, there could be just a smell or a sound or a song that comes on, and it's like, oh my gosh, why am I crying? It's been 6 months. It's like, no, that just brings those memories back. But I will say, grief is one of those things, if you don't walk through it and mm-hmm. try and walk around it, it's going to come back to bite you.
Mm-hmm.
It really will.
Yeah.
I heard somebody say once that grief is like the Grand Canyon. You can't ignore it, because you'll trip and fall and like break your hip, and now we know you die a year later.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't live there either.
Yeah.
You can't live there. So you visit it, you recognize the grandiosity of it and the impact
of it.
And you,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
And I
yeah.
thought that was a really beautiful way to put that.
Mm-hmm. And we're fortunate, there are places in town that they have grief support groups mm-hmm. and things like that too to
and
help.
And most communities do just reach out. I'm going to go out on a limb and have all of our hospital social workers send me hate mail. But I think if you didn't know where else to reach out in your community, that would be a starting place. Mm-hmm. You could call your local hospital and say, can I speak with a social worker? I have a quick question.
Yep.
I need to know if there's any groups on this.
Yeah.
And you can Google it. I mean, there's compassionate parent support mm-hmm. groups, you know, Google support groups in Brown County or whatever.
Wherever you live. Yeah.
Yeah. And there are a lot of different options more and more all the time. Some are online.
Yep.
You know, and some people prefer that. And some are in person. And, you know, when you go to these groups, you don't have to talk. You can just go and listen. And mm-hmm. that can be just as therapeutic for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Knowing you're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
For sure.
Yeah. You brought a notebook of like all kinds of notes, and we didn't give you a chance to say one damn thing. So I would like to ask you, like, what is it that you want to make sure that people know about hospice that we have not addressed?
You know, it's definitely a team on our part. It's not just nursing. It's a social worker as part of our team. There's our medical director. There's chaplain, if they choose. It's not about religion. It's about a high feeling of a higher power. You know, it's not to take the place of their own spiritual advisor. But in addition, we have CNAs to help provide bathing, personal cares. We can do homemaking, massage therapy. And like I say, a pharmacist sits on our team that we have on speed dial if we have questions and things like that, that we're struggling with how to manage nausea, things like that. So I want you to know that we all have our focus and mm-hmm. things like that, but it's truly, it's probably the most team-oriented thing I've ever worked with in nursing, and I think that's, you know, a huge positive.
And mm-hmm. along those same lines then, for people not just in our area, but anywhere, you know, if you're curious as to what hospice is, I mean, should they be asking about it, or is that the admission like, nope, I'm dying, so I guess once you get into hospice, you don't get out? Or
not,
you know,
true. Not right. True. Anybody can revoke hospice at any time. They decide that they heard about another specialized procedure or a clinical trial, they can revoke at any time and say, I don't want hospice. Doesn't mean they can't have it down the road. Mm-hmm. They can revoke at any time. Also, it costs nothing to have us come and evaluate a loved one.
Sure, yep.
You know, if you want to call and just say, we're not sure they would qualify for hospice, or if it's even something we want, we can come and make a visit wherever they are to just talk about what hospice is, what it isn't, mm-hmm. you know, and would they qualify? And oftentimes we have those discussions, and it's a week or many weeks later that they decide, yep, this is the route we want to go. Mm. I'm not here to twist people's arms to get them on hospice. Right. I'm just here to offer it and tell them the benefits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the respect that you have for people's decisions where they're at mm-hmm. is very apparent.
Yeah. And so important at that mm-hmm. time, because you feel like you're losing control. You're losing your mm-hmm. loved one. The person dying is losing control. You really respecting their decisions mm-hmm. is giving them some control, you know?
Yes, yes. And, you know, it's unfortunate, but, you know, but people die without hospice all the time, mm-hmm. and they have that decision, you know, mm-hmm. maybe the thought of it, you know, it just seems too prepared for that, you know, and you know, I feel like we can benefit them, but mm-hmm. ultimately it's their choice mm-hmm. if it's what they want to go with or not.
That's all my questions, man.
Me too.
It has been wonderful, though, spending this time with you.
We really, really appreciate it, because I think this information is so, I mean, we're all going one direction, right? Mm-hmm. There's no mystery here. So.
Jacob always tells me, I will say, God, this is killing me. And he's like, you've been dying since the day you were born.
Oh, that's a happy thought. But yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Realist.
I love his sense of humor. But seriously, this mm-hmm. is something, again, we're breaking stigma. We need to be talking about these things.
We have to talk about it.
Yes, and I really, really appreciate
this. It's not taboo.
This. No. Yeah.
And yeah. I hope our listeners not only realize it's not taboo, but it's can be a beautiful process. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I get to go to colonies, and they do it right.
Really?
They do. They, you know, they care for their loved ones. They take turns. They bring the body in. They have a wake the night before with, you know, it's so much more normal. Mm. You know, you'll see them bring the 1 and 2 year olds in and put them on the bed of their, you know, unresponsive mm-hmm. grandma and that. It's really special.
And so when you say colonies, we have Hutterite colonies here mm-hmm. in South Dakota. And it's a very unique sort of cultural experience. Mm-hmm. And so I bet that would be very interesting to be a part of that.
Well, and I think part of it is they always, you know, they live in a commune setting. Mm-hmm. So there's caregivers all over mm-hmm. and that are willing to step up and help. You know, if it takes two people to be in the home all the time, they got it.
Yeah. Wow. Mm.
Oh, that's amazing.
Well, thank you again for everything.
Yes, Lisa, thank you're you welcome. So much.
I'm not nervous anymore.
Yeah, that's right. Now you're calm. See?
easier to get or easier to be here than it is to get here, right?
I would agree. Yes. I think we all agree with that one.
Yeah.
Well, you guys, we are the Shrinks.
And that's a wrap.